Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alan Char, and enough of this tennis. Anyone for science? Coming up on this week's show, fertility expert Dr. Sammy Lee helps us unravel the headlines from this week's fertility conference in Lyon. He'll be telling us the very latest about the business of making babies. Leading landscape designer Charles Jenks casts his architectural eye over the Atlas detector, one of the experiments at the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, plus the truth about yawning, and music all the way from Antarctica, and live right here in the studio. Lunch, they say, is for wimps. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Rain has stopped play in Wimbledon, but it hasn't stopped play here in the pod. That said, the studio itself is literally being held together by sellotape and safety pins for a whole manner of reasons, all far too boring to tell you about. James, Bobby, Ian and Nell are all elsewhere this week, so joining me in the pod, he stole the show at Glastonbury with the world premiere of Ice Cream Man and the Jelly Incident. It's the troubadour physicist, Mr. Johnny Berliner.
Hello.
Can I just say you're calming me very much by being here. And a muted hello to Science Weekly producer Ben Green.
Why so muted?
Well, it says here in the script, muted hello to you. So I'm curious. I actually do know why it's muted. What happened to the studio this week? Tell me.
The studio blew up this week in a non-science experiment, I'm afraid.
What did you do? Pour water on it?
I might have done.
Anyway, it's sort of all being patched together as we speak. Anyway, let's get things going. Last week, the European Society for Human Reproduction and Embryology had its annual meeting. It threw up a whole manner of headlines about mothers giving birth to their own grandchildren, scientists freezing the eggs of five-year-old girls, and mice being bred from frozen sperm. Not human sperm, of course, that would be strange. Well, our special guest this week is Dr. Sammy Lee, a fertility expert from University College London. We'll speak with him in a minute, but first, let's hear from the Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample, who is at the conference for Science Weekly.
I'm here down in Lyon at the annual meeting of the fertility doctors. It's probably their biggest meeting that they come to in Europe. They come from all over to talk about pretty much every aspect of fertility treatment you can imagine. One of the strongest themes that's emerged this year has been different treatments for girls who have diseases or treatments to those diseases that ruins their fertility. And so ways of protecting these girls so they can have families later on in life. One of the speakers was Dr. Ariel Ravel at Hadassah University Hospital in Jerusalem. It's one of the biggest hospitals in Jerusalem. And he managed to take eggs from girls as young as 5 years old, ahead of them being treated for cancer. The eggs were then matured in a laboratory and frozen so that the girls could use those eggs when they were old enough to want to have a family. He told me how being able to have those eggs available for such young girls might make a huge difference to them in the future.
So the chances of those girls to get pregnant is very slight, is very slim, because of the aggressive treatment that they receive. And this new project now offers the parents and the girls a possibility of fulfilling a dream that not only the girl should recover from the disease, but would also be able to have children in the future.
It's not just girls with cancer that the fertility doctors have been focusing on. There are a whole range of other diseases which affect fertility. And we heard from Professor Sanglin Tan at McGill University about one woman who had donated eggs for her daughter who had a rare genetic condition called Turner syndrome. That syndrome leaves her with a genetic defect, a loss of an X chromosome, which means she won't be able to have children, won't be able to produce eggs herself. So her mother had donated eggs which the girl may choose to use if she wishes in the future. Prof Tan said that he saw no ethical problems with the work.
There was no coercion on anyone's part. She was doing it out of concern for her daughter, and her daughter and her daughter's future partner could choose to use them or not to use them in future. And secondly, she said she gave an example that if her daughter had kidney failure and she was giving a kidney to save her daughter's life, no one would be considering this to be ethically challenging at all.
I think these really showed the amount of imagination being put into solving people's very real problems by the fertility doctors. But there was other work presented here that was more futuristic. Giampiero Palermo at Cornell University talked about his team's attempts to clone male sperm. He did some studies in mice where he took the heads off the sperm and put them into hollowed out mouse eggs. He then managed to give them a little electrical jolt and divide them up so he had a few more of these cells to play with. He thinks that this technique could be used to increase the number of sperm available to men who don't produce any and certainly don't produce enough to use in IVF treatment.
I don't see the procedure as having the same concern that we have for human cloning. First of all, the embryo is a biparental contribution. You have paternal and maternal DNA that will create the embryo. We wanted to help men that have few sperm. So from one sperm, we would have more spermatozoa, more of those cells able to inseminate their partner eggs.
Prof Palermo's team managed to get some successful births from his cloned sperm, and he had at least 6 live births from the time of the conference, although many did die shortly after being born, although he's not quite clear what the reasons for that are. I think coming to this conference, you get a huge sense of the problems that people face in terms of fertility, but also the massive amount of work going on to overcome those problems and the huge lateral thinking that's going on in getting around them. It seems that the more advanced these techniques are becoming, the more contentious they're becoming too, and I think the ethical issues for the future are going to just get bigger and bigger.
So that was Ian Sample there reporting from Lyon. As I was saying, Sammy Lee, a lecturer in clinical embryology at UCL, is here with us in the studio. Sammy, thanks for coming in. Let me just quickly ask you to sum up some of the things you thought were interesting from this conference. I mean, this conference happens every year. We always get slightly outlandish headlines and things, but let's go to the science. What did you think was most interesting?
Well, it's very interesting thinking about how IVF changes kinship. So we have all these new ideas that people come up with, and they're turning grandmothers into mothers, they're turning mothers into grandmothers, they're doing all sorts of very, very strange things. So here we have a lady who's donating her eggs for her daughter. Maybe they'll be used, maybe they won't. If they're not going to be used, they might be donated to someone else. So it's all gone into the hat, and we'll see what's going to happen in the future. These things, kinship, I'm not so sure that kinship is a major ethical issue. Many years ago now, a lady contacted me because she wanted to have a child. She didn't have, apparently, functioning ovaries of her own. She wanted to have an egg donor, but she wanted to use her brother's sperm. I think this case was done. They had children. I don't think anything happened to them.
I think once you get beyond the headlines that these stories can sometimes generate, perhaps the reasons people do it is sometimes it's easier to understand once you understand that people are desperate for children. In your own line of work, and in fact, IVF doctors themselves, you have an incredible amount of power for over people who are genuinely very desperate to conceive. So how do you sort of balance that with testing treatments out on people and making sure that their interests come first?
I think this is a very important question. I think the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority are very concerned about the imbalance of power. Patients aren't empowered, and they should be as much as possible. So I think the issue is informed consent. And those of us who are providing treatment, we need to give patients, we need to give the couples as much information as we can, and we need to be honest. Now, we all like to do firsts, so this is a field where everyone is very keen to be up there and the first person to do a new treatment. So patients are always at risk of being guinea pigs. I don't think it's enough just to tell the patients, hey, you're going to be a guinea pig, we've not done this before, but if you really want to do it, we'll try. I think this has been done a fair bit in the past. I think I myself might be guilty of this. But I think in this day and age, we can't really do it this way anymore. We actually have to do it right. We have to run the treatments past an ethical committee. We have to make sure that we provide as much information as possible. And then we need to think about it and then think about it again. And if enough couples are keen to have it and are willing to subscribe to a proper study, then we might go ahead. But where we're providing or punting new treatments to individuals, I don't think this is a good idea anymore.
Professor Robert Winston, we had an interview with him recently where he really roundly criticised IVF doctors for exploiting people. And also he criticised the regulator, the HFEA, as you mentioned, for not doing enough to help patients. His main concern was that we were testing out untested treatments on patients and that the HFEA was doing virtually nothing to stop them. Do you agree that the HFEA has not been very effective in all of this?
They have a very, very difficult job. Now, in terms of regulating, they're supposed to look at how clinics go about their business. In terms of individual treatments, so long as it is not against the law, and the law is relatively clear on what might be done, what shouldn't be done, they cannot interfere. They are not really a policing authority as such. So if a clinic is doing something which is not beyond the law, and generally when you do firsts and you're doing new things, the law hasn't even thought about it. So of course, there might well be laws eventually on it, but at the time that these new things are thought up, there isn't. So the HFEA doesn't have eyes and ears everywhere. So generally, these new treatments will have been done way before the HFEA gets to hear about it, because the HFEA will only hear about it if it's successful. Go to Lyon and then you'll hear about
it. Or if it's gone totally wrong or something like that.
Yeah. Oh, yes. In fact, yes, if things go totally wrong, they will certainly hear about it and then there'll be a big hue and cry.
I alluded earlier to the fact that conferences like this, there's always sort of a week of very strong and kind of sickening headlines. Totally the fault of journalists, I think. How do you feel about that when you see that your work and your colleagues' work represented like this?
For myself, I can't really speak for my colleagues, but I kind of get quite a bit of enjoyment out of watching it all. It's a media circus, and
it really is, unlike any other bit of science, I think.
And not a lot of science, and not a lot that's really new, you know. But what I love about it is the invention of the journalists. How they're able to take something and package it in such a way to make it quite exciting, quite sexy, so that people will read it and enjoy it. And I think this is quite a good thing, because public understanding of science is all about engaging the public, making things interesting for them, getting them to look at it and then to talk about it. And I think if they talk about it, that is a good thing. And we live in an age of media.
You know, that's the kindest thing I've ever heard anyone say about journalists. All right, Sammy, thank you very much for all that. We're going to have you talking about some other stuff later on in the show, hopefully. Sammy's new website, by the way, is makingbabies.org.uk. I'm Alok Jha, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, we'll hear from the Antarctic rock stars as they prepare for their biggest gig so far. Plus, more from CERN, more on particle physics, and more music from Johnny Berliner. But first, it's time for a roundup of the other science and tech news that's been making headlines over the past 7 days. This is your News Jam.
News Jam.
Piranhas may have a fearsome image as bloodlusting hunters, but a new study indicates they may be of a more delicate disposition. Conservationists studying the fish in the Amazon basin say that they are, in fact, nervous and in fear of being eaten by predators, which is why they huddle in schools.
America went crazy last weekend for Apple's new iPhone, the $500 hybrid between a mobile phone and an iPod. But despite selling out of the new gadgets, things didn't go totally smoothly for Steve Jobs, as customers complained that they couldn't get their new phones to work.
Nearly a quarter of all energy processed by plants is either harvested by humans or wasted by us. That's according to a new analysis. In densely populated areas such as Europe and Southern Asia, the figure rises to more than 50%. And researchers say it makes bleak reading for those who support the use of biofuels as a long-term replacement for fossil fuels.
And finally, a new theory has been put forward to explain why people yawn. A psychological study from the State University of New York suggests that it may help cool the brain. Scientists found that subjects who were already cool and calm showed more immunity to this so-called contagious yawning.
And that was your News Jam. Ben and Johnny B, thank you both. A couple of things I think we can discuss from those stories. I don't believe that yawning study at all. Sammy, you're a doctor. Does it make any sense that yawning might cool your brain in any way?
Well, It's possible that there may be a physiological mechanism.
Sorry to put you on the spot there.
So there are diving reflexes. So when fish dive, some fish actually have a mechanism which makes their heart go much slower the deeper they dive. So if one thinks about it, maybe in the process of yawning, there may be a center at the base of the brain which responds to the yawning and then results in perhaps an increased blood flow or a decreased blood flow. Perhaps a decreased blood flow might cause more cooling, as well as giving you a brain attack.
I mean, I would have thought that just the simple answer is you just need some oxygen and that's why you breathe. Ben, you're yawning.
No, I'm not yawning, but I have heard that a theory as to why it's so-called contagious is that everyone is under the same atmospheric conditions when one begins yawning, so then naturally someone is going to yawn thereafter.
I've heard an entirely different explanation for the contagious yawn, which is that brains really quite like oxygen. So if you see someone else doing it, you
want to gulp some.
You want some too.
All right. And on that scientific discussion, I'm going to move that forward to anyone here looking forward to the iPhone? Anyone want an iPhone, in fact?
No,
everyone's shaking their heads.
I'd like one if it was free.
I tell you what, I saw this iPhone when it first came out and I thought to myself, nah, what's the point? It's probably, it'll just get broken or something. And then I saw, I don't know if anyone else has seen this on YouTube, there's a clip from the New York Times tech sort of guy there who sort of had it for a while. And there was an excellent clip of him going around with it. And it just really makes me want one now. It's just absolutely gorgeous, the whole thing. The tech people are listening to this will understand. If Bobby was here, he'd back me up on this. We're going to leave all of that there, by the way. People of Podland, please do get in touch if you have something to add on these topics, and let us know what you think about everything we've said, especially if you think we've got things wrong. All the details of how to get in touch with us, and there are a few, coming up at the end of the show. The British Antarctic Survey's band Nunatak. As you can imagine, being based in the Antarctic, they don't get much of an opportunity to play the crowds, but by the time you listen to this podcast, they'll have played the Live Earth concerts to a global audience of billions. Well, I spoke with Tristan Thorne, the violinist from the band, before their Live Earth gig to find out about the state of the sex, drugs and rock and roll at the South Pole.
No, actually, we're very well behaved down here after the rigours of our work and the full evening's practising. The conditions usually aren't conducive to rock and roll excess. We content ourselves with a mug of cocoa around a blazing primer stove.
What do you hope people are going to get from watching you? Obviously, it's a bit of a novelty to see people playing music down at the bottom of the earth like that. But what do you think hope people are going to take away from your performance?
Well, hopefully they'll appreciate as much as we do that stunning beauty of the environment down here. It really is a fairy tale landscape. I can't begin to describe it. Words would not do it justice. But hopefully the video footage will show something of that. And also I think the office back in Cambridge are keen that the awareness will be heightened of the British operation down here and encourage talented young scientists and engineers to come south in the future.
So that was Tristan Thorne from Nunatak. And believe me, it's not easy conducting a phone interview to a bunch of cabin-fevered men on the South Pole. Johnny B, let me ask you before we move on. Where's the strangest place you've played a gig?
I once did a gig in a lift that was placed on Brighton Beach, and you could fit only 10 people in the audience.
When you say a lift placed in Brighton Beach, I mean, did it move or was it just actually...
No, it was a stationary lift sat on the beach. It was brilliant because what you could do between songs, if you wanted some fresh air, you could just push the button and the doors opened and there was the ocean.
A functioning lift, that's incredible. A few weeks back, we brought you the first in a series of interviews featuring artists, actors and literary types giving their opinion of the amazing work going on at CERN in Geneva, the largest science experiment of all time. You've already heard from the Doctor Who actor, John Barrowman. Well, this is what happened when Charles Jenks, one of the world's leading architects, gave his professional opinion on the Atlas detector, the so-called Temple of Reductionism in the Large Hadron Collider. Here's our old friend, the particle physicist Dr. Brian Cox.
We're at one of the ends of the Atlas detector, and what we can see is the forward muon wheel, so the big golden muon detectors, 20 metres in diameter, to get some sense. It's an astounding structure.
Now, this is really very beautiful, isn't it? And I think a direct expression of the forces of movement, are they? Those end panels of the measuring the muon, is that?
Yeah, they measure muons.
And, you know, we call it, there's a movement in the art world called indexical art, where the index of what's happening creates the work itself, or iconic. It's also known in another way as iconic, because the icon, the image, comes out of the process. And it's fairly direct here, isn't it?
Yep, and one thing you can say actually is the size of the thing. It's not been built this big because this is how much money we had. It's this big because the energies of the particles that you want to contain in order to measure dictate how big the thing has to be. The more energetic the collisions, the bigger the thing has to be to contain it and therefore measure it. And it's that this energy, because the Higgs and the things that we don't know about are at this energy.
Well,
so
can
so
you,
the size
can,
is driven oh, by the by
right.
nature.
So a previous measurement of muons would be, say, two-thirds of that size, the
yeah,
previous accelerator?
Yep. So if you go to the accelerators at Fermilab in Chicago, which are 7 times less energy, then, you know, pretty much the detectors are 7 times smaller.
This reminds me very much of the plan in the 15th and 16th and 17th centuries of ideal cities in Italy. I don't know if you've ever seen them, where they are on the outside regular polyhedra, like a hexagon or an octagon, and then on the inside a circle. And of course you find the church and the palace the central square in the center, and then all the on these radiating avenues you find the inner buildings have the public buildings and the outer ones have the people living. And so it's like a defensive city, ideal city, by a man named Scamozzi in about 1660. Laid out the plan of your muon detector. You might look at it.
I wonder if he knew. If he had any inkling.
He was before his time. But you know, I mean, it is like a city in a way, isn't it, too? Because all of those micro elements are like little streets and, you know, houses. And
what you can see there, those pipes carry the gas into muon chambers. Muon chambers are full of gas, which is how they work.
It's certainly a mystery, isn't it? Because every time I hear it explained, how could emptiness be full of particles that come in and out of existence in microseconds? I go away saying, oh yes, I understand. And then 30 seconds later, I say, what?
I think the point, what quantum mechanics taught us, and it's a very mature theory now, it's 80, 90 years old, right? Is that anything that can happen will happen. If you've got energy, then it can crystallize into particles, matter and antimatter, and then it'll disappear again. And because it can, it does. And so that's the thing, as long as you've got energy. In fact, well, you don't even need energy because you can borrow it. So quantum mechanics even allows you to borrow energy for a short amount of time.
In a short amount of time. But yes, I know, but it sounds rather mysterious to say that, because it sounds awfully much like ether in the night. If you're saying that emptiness is full of nothing and that nothing jumps into and out of existence and split microseconds, it sounds first of all like ether, that in fact nothingness is full of potential somethingness all the time, everywhere there's the universe. So you know, it does sound like we've heard it before, and it sounds mysterious, and that reminds us that the heart of everything is a mystery, which is precisely what classical religions have claimed in a way, except they've claimed to know what the mystery is. Which is, you don't claim to know what the mystery is, but you still claim, or, I mean, maybe you don't claim it's a mystery. You just say that anything that can happen does happen.
One of the interesting things, I think, that I got from reading your book, it's something that I really firmly believe, that being a scientist, you walk a tightrope between being an engineer, in a way, a reductionist, I suppose, and having a sense of awe, which is and wonder at the universe, which is the thing that drives you to be a scientist in the first place. And it's very easy to forget one or the other. Saying things are mysterious is, to me, not a very scientific response, because then you essentially throw up your hands and say, well, it's mysterious, and I wouldn't want to advocate that position. But at the same time, you're absolutely right that if you lose your sense of awe or fail to convey the sense of awe to people that you're talking to about science, and you make it all too mechanistic, then you've lost a lot. In fact, you've lost your humanity. You've lost the reason that you want to do it in the first place.
Well, that was Dr. Brian Cox and the architect Charles Jenks. You can listen to the full interview as part of Science Extra this week. Head back to iTunes or the blog. Sammy, this is slightly outside your field. Particle physics, do you have anything to say?
Wow. You know, things suddenly existing and then not existing. Very exciting. And the emptiness. The emptiness isn't really empty. In a nutshell.
It's a soup of superparticles. Now, listeners, you know what we like to do with our big questions from the world of physics. Johnny B, I believe you've got a new song for us this week.
Yes, I do.
Go for it.
If I could be the captain of a subatomic submarine, I'd dive into an atom just to find the fundamentalist things. We'd see little chunks of matter that are strange and full of charm. And some particles have charge, you know, and some will do no harm. But even though they're elementary, I can't fathom what they do. 'Cause I don't understand this stuff, and I'll bet that you don't too. You got electrons, positrons, gravitons and photons, hadrons, kaons, pions and protons, leptons, neutrons, baryons and bosons, fermions, mesons, neutrinos and W particles, Z particles, tau psi Higgs and alpha particles, sigma particles, lambda particles, eta and omega particles, charged particles, charming particles, up, down, strange and spinning particles, bartomonium, muons and gluons and quarks. We're gonna do it again, but a bit faster. You got electrons, positrons, gravitons, photons, hydrons, kaons, pions, and protons, leptons, neutrons, baryons, and bosons, fermions, mesons, neutrinos, and W particles, Z particles, tau psi Higgs, and alpha particles, sigma particles, lambda particles, eta and omega particles, charm particles, charming particles, up, down, strange, and spinning particles, bartomonium, muons, and gluons, and quarks.
Woo! That, I tell you, if you slow that down, you'll get a full education in particle physics out of that song, I think. Johnny, thank you very much. As ever, you've been commenting and emailing in your droves over the past 7 days. They've been a bit surreal, to say the least. In regards to James Randison's interview with Sir David Attenborough a few weeks back, which some of you thought sounded a little echoey, Nathan Kennedy from the West Midlands asks,
in all fairness, and all things being equal, why wouldn't you interview Sir Dave in a bathtub?
Yes. Moving on, this is from Alice in Sweden.
Hello there, maybe the best science podcast group in the world. It's been a pleasure these past few weeks listening to the show, mostly because Nell has such a sweet and well-behaved English accent. There's plenty more reasons, of course, but they escape my mind at this moment. Anywho, I was hoping that you could do a podcast on string theory. I understand that it is not new to the science world, nor is it to myself, but maybe you could go in explaining certain features more deeply.
Alice, there's an extended interview with theoretical physicist Lee Smolin on our archives. If you go to guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts or go to iTunes right now, you'll find all you need to know about string theory there. Okay, we just have time for a final word with our special guest, Sammy Lee, lecturer on clinical embryology at UCL. Sammy, I just want to know, what do you think fertility treatment is going to be like in 10 or 20 years, after 10 more years of headlines and actual advances and things?
I think we're going to see many more ladies storing their eggs or their ovaries for the future. So they're going to freeze their fertility in time, they're going to have their careers, and then when they're ready, they will have their children. And that's the technology of freezing eggs and freezing ovaries, which has been highlighted at this recent symposium in Lyon.
And so the costs will go down and the practicalities will be much easier and so on, is that what you're saying?
I'm not sure that cost will actually go down. I think providing fertility treatment is always going to be quite expensive, but I think the efficiencies of it and the benefits that it brings, the possibilities, are many and varied.
Okay, let me ask that question from the other way around then. What's changed in the last 10 years then, since you came into the field? How is it different?
Two things. It's much more successful. When I first started, if you got a 10% success rate, you were supposed to be pretty good. Now, if you're not achieving 35%, you're not up there with the big boys. Secondly, I think there have been great changes, particularly with regard to sperm injection. So this is one of the things that has broken today, is that if you have been conceived by sperm injection, you might be a little bit mentally delayed in your development. So this sounds really scary, it's terrible. I'm sure everyone who has an ICSI baby has just jumped. But It's only within the first year at the moment that they've looked at it. So if you're a one-year-old child, you have a slightly slower development than a one-year-old child who was conceived by IVF. So it's no big deal yet.
I'm sure that all of that's going to go on and on. And Sammy, thank you very much for all of that. Well, that's it for this week. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed in the show, head to the blog, Facebook or MySpace, which still exists but seemed a bit old-fashioned now, doesn't it? For now, my thanks go to the mighty Johnny Berliner and our special guest, Dr. Sammy Lee. We've put links to both of them on our blog. Remember, we have a Dose of Science extra for you this week, the full half-hour interview from CERN with Dr. Brian Cox and Charles Jenks. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green with not an insignificant amount of help from Rachel Buchanan this week. I've been Alok Jha. Keep on keeping on.
Guardian Unlimited.